the first question. I cannot understand the philosophy of Zen. What should I do to understand it? Zen is not a philosophy at all. To approach Zen as if it is a philosophy is to begin in a wrong way from the very beginning. A philosophy is something of the mind. Zen is totally beyond the mind. Zen is the process of going above the mind, far away from the mind. It is the process of transcendence, of surpassing the mind. You cannot understand it by the mind. Mind has no function in it. Zen is a state of no mind. That has to be remembered. It is not Vedanta. Vedanta is a philosophy. You can understand it perfectly well. Zen is not even Buddhism. Buddhism is also a philosophy. Zen is a very rare flowering. It is one of the most strangest things that have happened in the history of consciousness. It is the meeting of Buddha's experience and Lao Tzu's experience. Buddha, after all, was part of the Indian heritage. He spoke the language of philosophy. He is perfectly clear. You can understand him. In fact, he avoided all metaphysical questions. He was very simple, clear, logical. But his experience was not of the mind. He was trying to destroy your philosophy by providing you a negative philosophy. Just as you can take out a thorn from your feet by another thorn, Buddha's effort was to take out the philosophy from your mind by another philosophy. Once the first thorn has been taken out, both the thorns can be thrown and you will be beyond mind. But when Buddha's teachings reached China, a tremendously beautiful thing happened. A crossbreeding happened. In China, Lao Tzu has given his experience of Tao in a totally non-philosophical way. in a very absurd way, in a very illogical way. But when the Buddhist meditators, Buddhist mystics, met the Taoist mystics, they immediately could understand each other. Heart to heart, not mind to mind. They could feel the same vibe. They could see the same inner world has opened. They could smell the same fragrance. And they came closer. And by their coming closer, by their meetings and merging with each other, something new started growing up. That is Zen. It has the beauty of Buddha and the beauty of Lao Tzu both. It is the child of both. Such a meeting has never happened before or since. Zen is neither Taoist nor Buddhist. It is both and neither. Hence the traditional Buddhists reject Zen. And the traditional Taoists also reject Zen. For the traditional Buddhist, it is absurd. For the traditional Taoist, it is too philosophical. But to those who are really interested in meditation, Zen is an experience. It is neither absurd nor philosophical, because both are terms of the mind. It is something transcendental. The word Zen comes from dhyana. Buddha used a certain language, a local language of his times, Pali. In Pali, dhyan is pronounced as zan. It is from zan that Zen has arisen. The word comes from zan. Zan comes from Sanskrit dhyan. To understand Zen, you need not make a philosophical effort. You have to go deep into meditation. And what is meditation all about? Meditation is a jump from the mind into no mind, from thoughts to no thought. Mind means thinking. No mind means pure awareness. One simply is aware. Only then you will be able to understand Zen through experience, not through any intellectual effort. Yoga says there is one nature, perfect and penetrative, present in all natures, one reality which includes all, comprising all realities in itself. The one moon is reflected wherever there is water, and all moons in water are comprised in the one moon. The moment you move beyond the mind, Suddenly you have moved from the many to the one. Minds are many. Consciousness is one. On the circumference, we are different. At the center, we are one. That one can be called the Brahma, can be called the God, the Absolute, the Truth, the Nirvana. Zen calls it no mind for a particular reason. If you call it the God, then people start thinking in terms of a person. They start imagining a person. Of course, the supreme most person, but their idea of personality is derived from human personality. It is a projection. It is not truth. The Bible says God created man in his own image. That is not true. Man has created God in his own image. That is far more truer. The God that we have created is our idea. It is anthropocentric. If horses were philosophers, then the God cannot be man. Then the God will be a supreme horse. If donkeys were philosophers, and who knows, they may be, they look very serious, always brooding, as if in deep contemplation, thinking of great things. You watch a donkey, and you will be certainly aware of this simple fact that donkeys are great thinkers. They are constantly somewhere else, far away, involved into great esoteric things. That's why people think they are fools. They are not fools, they are philosophers. If donkeys are thinking, if they are theologians, theosophists, philosophers, then God will be a supreme donkey. God cannot be a man. That's impossible. They cannot imagine God to be a man. Hence, Zen avoids any anthropocentric terminologies, any words that can become associated with our circumference. It does not call God Brahma, because that is a philosophical term. Maybe the best philosophical term, but even the best philosophical term is still philosophy. And philosophy is something of the mind. You can think about Brahma. In India, we have been thinking about Brahma for centuries, and there are as many interpretations of Brahma as there have been philosophers. Shankara interprets in one way, Nimbarka in another, Ramanuja is still in a different way, and so on and so forth. Not even two philosophers agree. And the dispute still continues. Philosophers go on quarreling. They never come to any conclusions. They cannot. Because mind has no capacity to conclude about the one. Even Shankara, the greatest non-dualist, remains a dualist deep down. He talks about the Brahm, the one. But to talk about the one, he has to bring Maya, illusion in. Then one becomes two. If you want to talk about the real, you will have to talk about the unreal. That is a necessity, absolute necessity. Without talking about the unreal, you cannot talk about the real. Without the unreal, the real loses all meaning. Human languages are dualistic. Hence, Shankara got into a trouble, a great trouble. He tried to sort it out, but he could not. And for 1,000 years, many philosophers who have followed Shankara have tried to find out a way out, but they have not been able. Even if you say that Maya means illusion, Maya means that which does not exist, but you have to talk about it. To make Brahm defined, you have to use illusion as a support. Otherwise, who will define? How you will define? The one remains indefinable. The one needs something else to define it. So, although the philosophy of Shankara is thought to be non-dualist, but it is not. No philosophy can be non-dualist. Zen is neither dualist nor non-dualist. It is not a philosophy at all. It simply says you move from the mind into the no mind and see. It believes in seeing. Yoga says the spirit operates naturally through the organs of sense. Thus the objective world is perceived. This dualism misses the mirror. But when the haze is removed, the light shines forth. Thus when each individual spirit and the objective world are forgotten and emptied, suchness affirms truth. When all words are gone, your mirror has no more dust on it, no more mist on it. When you look at things, you collect impressions. That is the dust. That's what you call thinking. When you see a rose flower, the rose flower is outside you, but it makes a reflection inside you. The rose flower will fade away by the evening. The petals will fall and disappear. But the inner rose flower, the rose that has become imprinted in your memory, will continue. It will remain forever with you. You can always remember it. And if you are a sensitive, aesthetic, artistic person, you can visualize it again and again. You can imagine it as if it is true. In fact, if you try, you will be surprised. You can even feel the fragrance of the rose again. If you create the whole imagination of the situation, the garden, the green grass, the dew on the grass, and you are walking naked feet on the grass, and the sweet smell of the earth, and the cool air, and the birds singing, you just create the whole atmosphere, and then suddenly you had discovered a beautiful rose flower hidden behind a bush, and the fragrance, and suddenly you will see the fragrance has come back to you. The imprint is there. The outer rose is gone, but the inner rose is alive. Now scientists, particularly brain experts, have discovered that if certain spots in the brain are touched by electrodes, certain memories become immediately active. Those memories are lying there, deep, frozen. Touching by the electrodes, they start becoming alive. A very strange experience. If your brain is touched by an electrode, at the point where the rose memory is lying deep, suddenly you will forget the present. You will be again in the same garden. Maybe 20 years have passed, but it will be again as real as if again you are in the garden. The same smell, the same wind, the same coolness, the same flower. And if the electrode is taken out, the memory disappears. Put the electrode back again in the same spot, and again the memory starts revealing. And one thing more has been discovered. You can do it thousands of times. Again and again the same memory comes. And again the memory repeats itself from the very beginning. The moment you remove the electrode, it seems there is an automatic rewinding. The memory coils back into the same original state. Touch it again with the electrode. As the electricity starts flowing, the memory begins from the beginning. You entering again into the garden. And the same sequence of events. And this can be done thousands of times. In fact, scientists say there is no limit to it. It can be done millions of times. The outer reality goes on changing, but the mind goes on collecting dust. And your consciousness is a mirror. And you are carrying so much dust from this life and from other lives. Such a thick layer of dust. That's why you cannot understand Zen. Because you cannot understand yourself. Because you cannot understand life. Because you cannot understand existence. Zen is not philosophy. It is existential, not philosophical. When the haze is removed, says Yoga, the light shines forth. Thus, when each individual spirit and the objective world are forgotten, an emptied suchness affirms truth. When all is emptied, you have forgotten all the memories, you have forgotten even your individual existence, your separate existence. You are no more an island. You have melted into the whole. You are not like an ice cube floating in the water. You have become water itself. This is what Zen is. Then suddenly, truth is revealed. Vision is clear, says Yoga. These four lines are of tremendous importance. Vision is clear, but there are no objects to see. There is no person. There is no Buddha. This is the ultimate declaration of Zen. This is the lion's roar. Vision is clear. This is a strange phenomenon. When there are objects to see, your vision is not clear because those objects are making impressions on you. Your vision cannot be clear. It is full of mist. When the vision is clear, there are no objects at all. Just clarity. Just pure consciousness, no content. Just seeing and nothing to see. Just watchfulness and nothing to watch. A pure observer, a pure witness, and nothing to witness. There is no person. And when there is nothing to witness, nothing to see, you cannot exist as separate entity. The I can exist only with the Tao. If the Tao disappears, the I disappears. They are part of each other. They are always together, like two sides of a coin. You cannot save one. This is what many stupid religious people go on doing. They go on saying to God, I am not, thou art. That is sheer stupidity. In the very saying you are, otherwise who is saying thou art? There is a famous poem of Jalaluddin Rumi. I agree with him up to a point. And then my disagreement starts. On the really essential point, I cannot agree with him. My feeling is he must have written that poem before he became enlightened. He was an enlightened man. But the poem is decisive. That it must have been written before he became enlightened. The poem is beautiful. Because sometimes poets say things almost like seers. But remember, they are almost like seers. There is bound to be some flaw. It can't be flawless. You may not be able to find out the flaw. Listen to the poem. Jalaluddin says, a lover comes to his beloved's home, knocks on the door. The beloved asks, who is there? And the lover says, I am your lover. And the beloved says, the house of love is so small, it cannot contain two. So please go back. When you are no more, then come again. The house of love cannot contain two. It can only contain one. So far, so good. The lover goes to the forest. He becomes an ascetic. He meditates. He prays to God. His prayer is only one: dissolve me. Many moons come and go. Months pass, years pass, and one day he comes back. He knocks again on the door, and the beloved asks the same question: who is there? And he says, now I am no more, only you are. And Rumi says, the doors open, and the lover is received in the home of love. There I don't agree. It is too early. Then who is the person who is saying, I am no more? Even to say that I am no more, you are needed. It is as foolish as you go and knock at somebody's house, and he leans out of the window and says, I am not at home. That is self-contradictory. You cannot say that. To say it is to prove that you are. Jalaluddin must have written this poem before he became enlightened. He should have corrected it. But these enlightened people are crazy people. He may have forgotten all about the poem. But it needs correction. I can do the correction. I will like to say that the beloved says, you go back again. Because you are there still. First you were positively there, now you are negatively there. But it makes no difference. The lover goes back. Now, there is no point in praying, because prayer has not helped. In fact, prayer cannot help. In prayer, the duality persists. You are praying to somebody. God becomes your Thou. God cannot help. Now he becomes a Zen monk. Not a devotee, but really a meditator. He simply goes deep within himself, searching and seeking, where is this I? He tries to find it out, where it is. And anybody who goes in is bound not to find it, because it is not there. It is non-existential. It is only a belief. So he searches and finds nowhere. So he comes back, knocks on the door. The beloved asks the same question, who is there? And there is no answer. Because there is nobody to answer. Just silence. She asks again, who is there? But the silence deepens. She asks again, who is there? But the silence is absolute. She opens the door. Now the lover has come but he is no more. There is nobody to answer. He has to be taken inside the home, taken by the hands. He is completely, utterly empty. This is what Zen people call emptied suchness. Vision is clear, but there are no objects to see. There is no person. There is no Buddha. Everything has disappeared. Zen has achieved the ultimate peak of enlightenment. Hence it can say that there is no enlightenment either. Because if the enlightened person goes on thinking, I am enlightened, he is not enlightened. If he claims enlightenment, then he is not enlightened. Because every claim is the ego claim. Enlightenment is not a claim. It is a silent presence. Don't try to understand Zen. Go within yourself to find out who are you, where are you. You will not find anybody there, just pure emptiness. And then vision is clear. No person, no Buddha. All is silent, utterly silent. There is nothing to say. In that silence, one becomes truth. Not only that one knows truth, one becomes truth. That is the only way to know it.